Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that talks about film, science fiction, entertainment. My name is Jeff Palermo, and I will be your host. Today is the very first episode of Sci-Fi on Screen, and we're going to be talking about The Matrix. The Matrix is a film directed by two brothers from Chicago, Andy and Larry Wachowski. The film was released in 1999, and it was an instant classic. Background first on The Matrix. The Wachowskis sold a script entitled Assassins to Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers bought Assassins, and they bought two other films in addition, Bound and The Matrix. So they made Bound, and it was a success. They did very well with Bound. Once Bound was a success, they approached producer Joel Silver with the idea for The Matrix. They're huge fans of anime, and they're fans of Ghost in the Shell, which, if you listen to my first podcast, you'll know is a very famous anime. It was released in 1995 by Mamoru Oshii. So they showed Joel Silver Ghost in the Shell, and then they got some underground comic book guys to draw like a huge shot-by-shot storyboard for the film, presented it to Joel Silver, and they were basically sold. I'm going to jump right in. So when the movie opens, you notice that the Warner Brothers label is, I think it's the first time this ever happened. The Warner Brothers label is an odd color. It's kind of gray-greenish color. So from the minute, before the movie even opens and you're in credits, you kind of already know you're in for something special. Something different, I should at least say. So as the credits roll, you get these cascading green characters, which if you've seen Ghost in the Shell, you know that's a direct homage. So the film opens as these green credits are rolling. There's a conversation between two characters who you don't know, and they're talking about someone they seem to be watching or listening to. You hear Trinity say immediately, something is going on with the line. Did you hear that? The call is traced. Obviously, if you watch the film, you realize that Cypher, one of the characters, one of the crew members of the Nebuchadnezzar, is already betraying her. So he's already tracing. He's already trying to set up Trinity and take her down one by one. Now, one of the things that I want to talk about for The Matrix, why I think it's such a really good film. First of all, this is a film by two hungry guys. The film is lean and mean, and they, not for nothing did they do Urban Legend has its 600-page storyboard for this film. They know exactly what they want. And every shot counts. And I'm constantly going to be coming back to this. It may get a little annoying, but the film is just lean and it moves so incredibly well. Say what you want about the totality of the film, but it's a lean, mean action machine. Straight away, the cops are going upstairs, and they break into the room where Trinity's sitting. And the camera is positioned in front of Trinity. So you're looking through her triangular hole of her elbow because her hands are behind her head. And already it's cool. Already you realize that these are guys who are very interested in where they're going to place the camera. They try to arrest her, and then again, boom, you're into something you have never seen before in film, which is their freeze frame 360-degree shot as she jumps up and is about to kick ass on all these guys. The effect is done by surrounding the actor with one small camera per degree. Computer times the exposures really quickly. So it's like one a second or something like that. And so the actor does the shot in this circle of cameras. And so you get that wonderful freeze frame point of view, which is The Matrix just. So here you are, like in the first sequence of the film, and already you're looking at something you haven't seen before. And then the action sequence. So they're in a dark room. She jumps up, kicks a guy, and runs up a wall, and lights are swinging back and forth, and flashlights are giving effects. And before you realize it, she has killed everyone, and she's now alone standing in the room. While this is happening, you have the Men in Black, Agent Smith, and the agents. Agent Smith is played by Hugo Weaving, and Hugo Weaving enters the scene with his laconic drawl. He's an Australian, and he did a very flat, laconic American drawl for this film. It's very striking at first, but you soon come to get used to it and very much appreciate it. And I didn't mention Trinity is played by actress Carrie Ann Moss. Fun Matrix factoid is that Carrie Ann Moss once starred in a TV show called The Matrix back in the early 90s. Bizarre. if you think about it. I mean, I don't think that word ever came up in popular culture before these two things. So very strange little moment. So now there's a chase, the agents, and immediately, I don't know if it's done super clear, but you realize the agents arrive and they're chasing Trinity, and she's having this conversation with Morpheus, who you haven't met yet. You don't know who he is. It's just Lawrence Fishburne's wonderfully low voice, very terrific voice. And somehow she has to find an exit. So she has to get to another location to get out. And when, you know, as a viewer, we don't know what that is yet, but there's this wonderful chase across rooftops. Again, shot by shot, they're running up and down these sort of these tented roofs, and Trinity's being chased. And then suddenly you realize you're in some other kind of movie, because immediately Trinity jumps an enormous distance between two buildings, and then is followed by the agents. So something is going on here. And as a first-time viewer, you have no idea why these people can perform the superhuman feats that they can. And one of the agents chasing her lands very much like Motoko in one of the scenes from Ghost in the Shell. Again, another, there's no question in my mind, opening with a super secret agent female as Ghost in the Shell opens, you know, not a surprise. Trinity makes it out. She runs to a phone booth, and then you see one of the agents. And then I think at this point you get a sense that the agents travel instantaneously into other people's bodies. They can morph into anyone. And again, as a first-time viewer, you don't know what the fuck that's about. An agent jumps right into a truck. Trinity runs into a phone booth. She picks up the phone. The truck smashes the booth. You don't know what's going on. They don't show you the effect of anything happening to her, so you don't know how. Except the agents arrive on the scene right afterwards. They realize, you hear the phrase, "She got out." And then another phrase, "The informant is real." I think that scene, the cipher angle in that scene, was the cipher was sort of proving that he is a mole to the agents. I think he probably made contact with the agents sometime earlier, and the agents were like, "Prove it." And so he said, "Okay, I'm going to give you Trinity." And he does. He tries to, anyway, and she makes it out. What they realize is they do have an informant in Morpheus's inner circle. And you don't know any of this, except that there is an informant who possibly tried to rat her out. So then we move on to Neo. We meet Neo, who's played by Keanu Reeves. We meet Neo in his apartment. Something odd is happening to his PC. It seems like his computer is talking to him. He knocks on the door. So Neo, it looks like Neo's selling programs, like hacking programs. You get the sense that he's sort of, you know, he's a low-level hacker. The computer tells him to follow the white rabbit, and he has no idea what that means. And then there's this great moment where his client arrives. It's this group of people all dressed in leather. He goes to get the product, and the product is in a book called Simulacra and Simulation by Jean Baudrillard, which is a famous critical theory book written in the mid-century, which is a little, you know, again, a little Easter egg for those who know what they're getting at. And there's a scene when Neo opens the door and hands him the program, where the guy standing there says, "You're my savior, man, my own personal Jesus Christ," which is, of course, an allusion to the fact that he kind of will become the savior of the human race. Of course, you don't know that yet. It just sounds like a throwaway line. And then they ask him to come out and hang with them, and he says no, but the girl turns and hugs the guy, and she says, "Come on, it'll be fun." And as she does, it's this great zoom, this great camera zoom, and there's a white rabbit on her shoulder. And there's this little, this music cue that comes up. Very cool, right? And all of a sudden he changes his mind. "Yes, I'll go. So in the dance club, you know, you have I think they did one in every movie, the Wachowskis dance club scene. People are dancing in cages, in leather. It's kind of preposterous, but, you know, people are dressed fairly cool, so you kind of go with it. Neo is standing by himself in a corner, and he's approached by Carrie Ann Moss, who you know from Trinity from the earlier scenes. They have this conversation, and you find out, you know, that she's this famous hacker who hacked what they call in the movie the IRS D-Base, and this is back and forth. And Carrie Ann Moss, just to start out, you know, the great thing about Trinity in this film is that she plays it with such conviction, and it's a physical conviction as well. There's something about her eyes, there's something about her face. She has terrific eyes. There's a humanness and a vulnerability in her eyes, but man, she is capable. She is the warrior, you know, in this film. There's a very tactile sense of her proficiency at what she does in every move that she makes, and I have to give credit to Carrie Ann Moss here. She's terrific. She really pulls it off. You don't doubt for one minute that Trinity is, like, seriously badass. Not a token female action hero. Like, Trinity is the real deal. The next scene, Neo wakes up. He's late for work. And there's a scene in the building that he works. And the building's called Metacortex. And he's talking to his boss, and there's some guys squeegeeing the windows, doing window washing outside. Again, there are foreshadowing these little throwaway lines that are clues to the rest of the film. His boss is saying, you believe you are special, that the rules do not apply to you. And of course, that is something that Morpheus is going to tell him as well later on, that, you know, when he understands what the Matrix is, he's going to tell Neo that they don't apply to you because you are, you know, he thinks he is the one. Kind of getting ahead of myself in the movie, but I'm sure most people listening to this podcast have seen The Matrix, so I'll take a leap. And then another throwaway line by his boss is that you have to make a choice, Mr. Anderson. This choice is to be at his desk on time, risk getting another job. But of course, he soon is going to have to make a real choice to take the blue or the red pill as offered by Morpheus. Another really cool sequence. And again, you know, you're in one sequence after another. That is such a lean film. You're finding out about character. It's moving the story forward. It's shot very interestingly. You know, it's this ineffable quality I notice when I'm watching a film, when I know the director's interested in where the camera's going. Obviously, I'm not a director, right? All directors are interested in where the camera's going. There are a lot of directors who are very showy with their camera angles, but there's just something about how they put this movie together and how tight it is, shot for shot, and how, because the shots are, the camera's directly overhead, it's a low angle shot, there's an odd angle shot, there's a guy in the, you know, guy in the street with a long shadow. Every shot has something in it that's just a little bit interesting to the eye. You're just like, there's just like a sense of, okay, the shot is, you know, capturing the action and we're moving the story forward. But there's also in every shot, like, oh, this is really cool. And as I go through this film, you're going to hear, like, every other shot that this little thing is cool and that's a sharp shot that they did. And anyway, it makes for just a really enjoyable and immersive experience. So now the classic, you know, Neo and Morpheus conversation over the cell phone, which is just, it's just wonderful. Neo's at work. It's a nondescript place. He's sitting in a cubicle. A FedEx man delivers him a package. He opens it up. It's a phone. And the minute he opens the package and gets the phone, it rings. And it's Morpheus. Again, first-time viewer, it's the same voice that we've heard speaking with Trinity in the first sequence of the movie. But then Neo confirms this when he says, Morpheus. And the guy, Fishburne on the other end, says, yes. Terrific voice. So there's this great sequence that somehow Morpheus knows exactly what's going on, and he walks Neo through, go to this other cube, wait, run to the end of the hall, go here, go into this door. Meanwhile, Agent Smith and other agents are there to get Neo, and so Morpheus is trying to guide him out. And so eventually, he brings Neo out to a scaffold, or outside the building, and basically says, look, you have to get to that scaffold and get to the roof, or the line is like, there are two ways out of that building. One is that scaffolding to the roof. The other is in their custody. I leave it to you. What I like about this is Neo fails. He tries to get around one obstacle, but he's standing on the outside of a building, like 20, 30 stories up, and he drops the phone, and the phone drops down, and so you get the sensation of exactly how high he is. And he tries to make one move towards the scaffold and fails miserably. And then the next shot, he's being led out of the building by Smith. Our hero has failed right off the bat, which, again, it's terrific. Subverting audience's expectation. I feel like in lesser hands, Neo makes it to the roof and there's Morpheus and you're off right away. Trinity is there monitoring things. So when they bring him into the car, the agents, you see it through Trinity's rearview mirror of her motorcycle. And it's a crystal clear shot. And again, it's just like eye candy. You're like, ah, cool shot. So the next scene is in an interrogation room. It's Neo with Smith. And it's the first time that they've met, facing off against each other. This is Hugo Weaving totally owns this scene and takes his time. And everything's done very deliberately, opens the folder. And has this, you know, his wonderful laconic drawl is in full swing. So he interrogates Neo. Neo basically tells him to go fuck himself. Then there's this incredible scene where you know, he tells Neo, Neo's like, I want my phone call. And Smith is like, well, what good is the phone call if you can't speak? And this flesh starts extending from his upper lip and lower lip to cover his mouth. It's a creepy sequence. That's not over yet. And they get him down on the table, and they hold him down, and they put this bug in him, which is very Star Trek II Wrath of Khan. But this time it goes in his belly button, and not like Chekhov and Terrell, where they Khan put it in their ears, which is gross. This is pretty gross too, though. So all of a sudden, Neo wakes up in his bed. He thinks what just happened was a nightmare. You, as the audience member, are not sure whether he dreamed the whole thing. Then the phone rings, and it's Morpheus. Basically, Morpheus tells him to meet him across the Adam Street Bridge. Now, this is the first time in the film that things aren't so precise, because even Morpheus says, this line is tapped, so I must be brief. And he goes on to tell him, if they knew how important you were, you'd already be dead. If they only knew, basically, giving up the ghost on the phone. So it's an odd thing. The line is tapped, you know, so I'll tell them everything. Very strange. So you're into the next sequence. It's raining again. Beautiful. They're great with rain and darkness and shadows. You know, he's there on the bridge. Car comes by. One of the car that the Morpheus' team uses, where the front and rear doors open sort of opposite each other. So the front door opens as normal, but the rear door opens where the hinge is sort of behind you, not in front of you. So they both open kind of opposite each other. So just cool. Just a cool car. I don't even know what the make of it is. I'm sure you can look it up on Wikipedia and you'd get it very quickly. Neo gets in the car. Trinity's in the back seat. And now there's two new characters we haven't met are in the front seat. I believe it's Apoc and Switch. Apoc's driving. So Switch turns around, pulls a gun on him. And she's like, take off your shirt. And he looks at Trinity, and Trinity's like, you have to trust this, Neo. They stop the car. Neo's like, fuck that. He opens the door to get out. And again, if you're doing a hero's journey, you know, second refusal of the call, he's basically like, screw you people. But of course, Trinity talks him into it. And there's another throwaway line here, again, another allusion, if you're watching the film a second or third time, where Switch says, listen, Coppertop, it's our way or the highway. And of course, you know, he will find out that he is, in fact, a battery eventually when this big reveal happens, not too far in the future. Pull into the place where they're going to meet Morpheus, and you've got a camera looking straight down, and you're following the rain. It's like straight out of a comic book. I mean, there's no question. It's just, again, and it's skewed angle, and you're looking down, and the Wachowskis are like, as I've heard, a phrase that I've heard somewhere here and there on the web called ruin porn. And there's definitely ruin porn in The Matrix. You know, these buildings are, wherever they're inside in a building, it's gross, it's coming apart, there's plaster everywhere, everything's green and brown. Finally, there is Lawrence Fishburne as Morpheus. It's a great scene. You know, he's got these glasses, pince-nez, I guess they used to call them, where there's no, he clips them on his nose and they're just there. And extremely highly reflective. Fishburne is wonderful. There's this incredible clipped diction that he uses, kind of Star Trek-y, in that there's a certain way, you know, he's speaking very in a very clipped fashion, enunciating everything, so it's very clear. And there's this wonderful scene between the two of them. They sit in these chairs, and Morpheus basically lays it out. This is about as much as I can tell you. The rest you're going to have to see for yourself, and there's not much more I can describe. How do you want to roll? There's a red pill, blue pill. And well, just to back up a little bit, Morpheus gives him his first description of the Matrix. First-time viewer, you're like, he's like, well, the Matrix is all around you. It's in this, it's in that. It's when you pay your taxes, you feel it, X, Y. He's trying to describe that they're in the Matrix. And of course, you know, from Neo's point of view, he has no idea. It's, again, this scene is very much trying to tell a fish that it swims in water, right? And that's what Morpheus is trying to do. And during the scene, there are these great shots of Morpheus close up, and you see Neo reflect in his mirror shades. And especially there's one shot when Neo reaches for the, I think it's the red pill. Even in the glasses, you see Neo's arm come out. Like, it's just, they just give a shit, you know? They're very into detail. So he takes the red pill, swallows it, and then all of a sudden, you go into a side room and you meet more of Morpheus's team. Joe Pantoliano is in there. And I believe there's one other character who I don't exactly remember. But so they put Neo in a thing, and they're telling him that, oh, we're looking for your input-output carrier. It's a lot of technobabble that he doesn't understand, and we don't really understand either. But at some point, he's looking at a mirror, and the mirror which is old and cracked, suddenly kind of liquefies, and he sticks his finger in it and pulls his finger back, and the mirror now is like crawling up his hand and up his arm. And there's a little bit of a tension thing going on here because they're supposedly trying to, quote, find him, and we don't really know what that means yet. They're trying to find him, and this thing is going up Neo's arm and going up his head, and then all of a sudden, it goes down his throat. We cut to a classic science fiction trope, and they are by far not the first people to do this type of thing, but they do it well. You see Neo wake up from this gooey, slimy bath that he's in, this sort of amniotic fluid, and he sits up, and he looks around, and all of a sudden he realizes there's someone next to him and above him and below him. There are thousands upon thousands of pods with people like him, you know, hooked up to these machines, towers and towers, thousands of them. And it's right out of Philip Jose Farmer's Riverworld. If you're a Riverworld fan, I do not mean any of the filmed Riverworlds that were debuted on Sci-Fi. Do not even speak to me about those things. But the opening scene, some of the opening part of Riverworld is that the main character, Richard Francis Burton, who is the actual Richard Francis Burton from history, is awakened by some alien presence to a very similar thing where he just sees bodies stacked endlessly. And this after remembering his own death. Right out of Riverworld, and if you're a science fiction fan as I am, you know, this trope is not new, but they nailed it. They did it really well. Soon, this flying mech comes up, realizes that he's awake, unscrews something in the back of his head. All of the wires that are in him pop off, and the whole thing flushes. And Neo goes for some long flush down a series of tubes, falls in the water, and then all of a sudden some light comes on him, and some huge metal claw picks him up out of the water, pulls him in, and Neo's translation from the Matrix into the real world is complete. Now we're introduced to the hovercraft. And the next sequence is done with Neo alternately waking and sleeping from his point of view. So we get to see that he's on a hovercraft and he is completely helpless physically. He's told, you know, he asks Morpheus, why do my eyes hurt? Morpheus says, because you've never used them. He's stuck with 1,000 needles and they're using sort of electrostimulation therapy to rehabilitate his body because he's been laying in that pod his entire life. The next sequence is Neo's training. This is very much like the martial arts films of yore, where, you know, the training sequence, or like the Rocky films, the training sequence. And basically, before anything happens, I should say before the training sequence, Morpheus tells him about the nature of the Matrix. When Neo's ready, Morpheus finally says, are you ready to find out what the Matrix is? He's brought out onto the main deck of the hovercraft. He sits in this chair and a huge spike is put into the back of his head where a hole still remains. Then it's he and Morpheus in this sort of white space. It's very reminiscent, if you've seen THX 1138, Lucas's student film at USC, straight out of that film. This is a classic sci-fi sequence where you have exposition. There's nothing that you can't help it. You know, in sci-fi films that you have exposition, it's necessary. But this is done perfectly. The end of the, you know, Morpheus basically tells him it's way in the future, the world is a mess, the machines run everything, and sort of ends up telling him that, you know, humans are grown. He's seen the fields where human beings are no longer born, they're grown. And at the end, holds up a battery. What is the Matrix? A computer-generated dream world meant to keep human beings distracted and under control while they are made to feed the machine's civilization. You as a viewer, you know, take that metaphor as you like, but it's a wonderful metaphor for kind of how our society works in a sense. The youth are born and raised and you know, we're sold the system of capitalism, which I am too small a mind to possibly judge what effect and how good or bad it is in terms of a way to run the world. That'll be decided thousands of years from now. But it is sort of a metaphor. The new blood is taken every generation to continually feed the system of control and two political parties and selling and profit and loss. And the great thing about the film is you can take that and kind of go with it on your own, but the film quite literally is representing it. In part of the explanation, Morpheus says to Neo, welcome to the desert of the real. That is a phrase, I think, in some commentary that was sort of attributed to Jean Baudrillard, or one of his compatriots, wasn't exactly a quote, but it was might have been a chapter in one of his books or one of his books. But again, another cultural Easter egg. Neo freaks out, and then later on, Morpheus explains why, you know, Neo's so important, and he explains that there was a man born inside the Matrix who could change everything. Prophecy basically says that one day that man will be reborn, and Morpheus thinks it's Neo. Now, we have no idea why Morpheus thinks it's Neo, what constitutes the one, how he's been looking for Neo, like what are the traits of the one that he's looking for. But regardless, we realize we're in a Chosen One story now. At one point, Tank, who's one of the operators aboard the Nebuchadnezzar hovercraft, tells Neo that there is a last human city called Zion, and, quote, buried deep underground where the earth is warmer, unquote. I mean, they're taking a little leap with that one, but whatevs, right? So basically, now the next phase, Neo is still processing this, and he needs to be trained. He needs to be trained in how to operate in the Matrix. And Tank starts to train him. And basically, the next little thing we get in this movie is this notion of instant knowledge. Neo's laying on a couch. Tank says, we're going to, you know, start you with some combat training. And he holds up a little diskette, and Neo's like, I'm going to learn Kung Fu. He puts the diskette in, and he presses a button. And within, like, 10 seconds, you know, Neo's, like, knows Kung Fu. So the knowledge of this entire fighting style has been downloaded into Neo's brain, and he knows it. For the next 10 hours, he absorbs, like, every combat fighting style, weapons fighting style, you know, you assume just every fighting style known to man in this great sequence. You know, he just kind of drinks it up. And then finally, Morpheus wants to test his knowledge. So they have their first little sparring duel. This is the first time we're getting into the martial arts aspect of things. Although we had some with Trinity, this is the first time we're setting it up. So the next scene is in a dojo, straight out of any kind of martial arts action movie. Basically, Morpheus is saying to Neo, hit me if you can. A bit of the style here. What's terrific about this is the Wachowskis are huge fans of Asian martial arts films, and they hired a guy named Yang Wu Peng. He's been choreographing the Asian martial arts styles of Wushu, and since the Wachowskis used him now, he's like basically choreographs everything that's martial arts. The great thing is that you can tell that Fishburne and Reeves have been working in this style because it's long takes and they're medium range, which is great. So you get to see their bodies and you get to see how they fight. I need to diverge a little bit into modern filmmaking and fighting and how things are shot. You know, since the late 80s, early 90s, the Blizzard of Cuts style has been really taken over in action movie directing. Things are cut in such a way where you don't really see full ranges of motion and back and forth. You know, there's a cut of a punch, cut of a kick, cut of someone jumping out of the way, cut of a face, cut of a punch. Although it's impressive and very kinetic, you know, things are being, this incredibly potent action is in front of your face at every shot. After a while, it loses, there's no art to it. I mean, yes, there's an art to the cutting of it. But in terms of two people fighting each other, it's very flashy. And what you never get are the mechanics of the fight. The great thing here is that the Wachowskis know this. They've actually choreographed these battles, these fights between, for right now, they choreographed this fight, you know, shot for shot, punch for punch, kick for kick. So they pull the camera back. And although the camera may swing left and right to follow a punch, you get to see the whole fight and you get to see the mechanics. How does Neo block a punch from Morpheus? What happens when Morpheus throws a punch, and what happens when Neo throws a punch or a kick, and how are these moves put together in a strategy? The Wachowskis do this terrific. So you have these long takes, and when they do use cuts and change the camera angle, it's very creative. There's a scene where Neo runs up a wall and then flips back over Morpheus, and the camera pulls way back. And so, you know, what you never have during, you know, martial arts fights is like a long shot, seeing a larger strategic shot of this fight. It's done really well. It's done really well. And the fight is very dramatic. It's done in stages. First, it's Neo trying out his new skills, realizing that Morpheus is just way more skillful than he is. And then the fight breaks, and Morpheus is like, now he's training him. He's teaching him, like, how did I beat you? And he's trying to get Neo to recognize that they're not breathing air. They don't have muscles. You know, that this isn't the thing in his brain that's normalized because of the way he's lived his whole life, is that this is actually a real place. You know, you're faster than me. And Morpheus is like, how is that possible? This isn't a place where I'm using muscles or breathing air, or you either. How is it possible that I could be faster than you? Now we get into the metaphysics of the Matrix, you know, and the spiritual sort of training, which martial arts films always do. It's terrific, you know. And so there's a point to the fight. And that's the thing that I'm going to go over more and more in these podcasts, is that directors can lose audiences so easily by making a fight not matter, you know. And that's something I'll get into when I do the Matrix sequels, where I think the sequels lose their potency, I should say. You know, the fights don't mean as much, or when the fights happen, or where the fights happen, for a large part. So right now, this fight matters. It matters, number one, because this is Neo's first experience, so it's fresh, number one. Number two, Morpheus is trying to teach him. He's trying to say, you're somewhat superhuman. You have to allow it to happen. And near the end of the fight, we see Neo throws a few punches that are preternaturally faster. And you see this visually, and Morpheus even looks at it. The Nebuchadnezzar crew monitoring it sort of are looking. Everyone's blown away in that moment about Neo's a flash of potential in him, right? It's a terrific sequence. And again, it's again part of the beginning of the Matrix's sort of metaphysical or spiritual theme that Morpheus is trying to tell Neo, listen, you know, it's the very way that you think about the reality around you that's the problem. If that shifts, you're going to be so much more than you were. And it's a great theme for a sci-fi action movie that's, you know, in the solid B-movie mold. They load what's called the jump program in a flash. And another great thing, what makes the first Matrix movie so wonderful, is that you're continually changing settings. You know, you were on the hovercraft. Now you were in a dojo, right? And now you're on a rooftop in a major metropolitan city. Morpheus basically looks at Neo and he says, you've got to leave it all behind, Neo. Fear, doubt, disbelief, free your mind. And he leaps to the next building in this impossibly long jump, obviously expecting Neo to follow in his footsteps. Then we cut back to the Nebuchadnezzar, and it's great. We get a little dramatic build-up where they're like, no one's ever made their first jump. We see what happens if he misses. I don't know. And Trinity, like, come on, you can do it, you know. And Neo runs, and he jumps and falls right on his face. Fails the second time. And so this is terrific. This is, again, the sequence where Morpheus is talking him around the office on the phone. He fails. And now this sequence where he is expected to, you know, make this next, quote, leap, he can't. And he's not ready yet. And again, this is another sub-theme that's built into the film. He's not yet ready to make that leap. Theme's going to come back over and over again until the end of the movie, actually. And it's terrific. It's the Wachowskis are very, very wise about spiritual transformation and actually what it takes to transform yourself from your normal way of living in the world to a whole different view and a whole different way of living. How difficult it is, and they visualize it over and over again. After that, back on the deck of the hovercraft, Neo, they pull the spike out of Neo's head. You realize he's bleeding. And so he asks Morpheus, but it wasn't real. And now you're given the information. The mind makes it real. And Neo says, if you die in the Matrix, do you die here? And Morpheus is like, the body cannot live without the mind. So the stakes just go up. He realizes now that anything he does in the Matrix, it's for the marbles. It's not just a virtual world that if you get killed, you wake up. If you get killed, you die. Which is a very, very smart thing, because how else are you going to create drama in this film if you can die 1,000 times in the Matrix and it doesn't matter? Then we're on to another sequence where Neo and Morpheus are walking down what looks like modern city street, and there's hundreds of people. Looks like a New York City rush hour. Morpheus is telling him about agents and the nature of what the agents are, and that the agents can actually inhabit any human being at any time, which makes everyone who's still jacked into the Matrix potentially an enemy. And I guess, too, giving our heroes the moral freedom to kill all of the people against them. Because if you think about it, you know, they kill a lot of cops, kill a lot of people in this movie. From our perspective, these people are you know, cops trying to do their job, or civilians. The Wachowskis are sort of giving their characters the moral leeway to do this killing by saying, you know, potentially anyone can be an agent. Anyone jacked into the system can be killed, can be inhabited by an agent. And that's done by a woman in a red dress who stands out from the crowd, and Neo follows her with his eyes. And then when he turns back around, the woman is morphed into Agent Smith. they freeze the program, which is a really cool notion. They end the sequence by Morpheus again telling Neo, you know, you must understand that agents are still bound to the system. So they're still sort of bound by the rules of the Matrix, which can be bent, but that Neo is not bound by the rules of the Matrix. And Neo says, so what are you saying? You know, I can dodge bullets. And Morpheus, of course, says, when the time is right, you won't have to. And of course, it's a foreshadowing to the end of the film when Neo doesn't have to do a damn thing. And he just stands there. And his realization of the nature of the Matrix truly gives him ultimate control over it. The next sequence is you're introduced to the Sentinels. Now, Sentinels are out in the real world, and they look like, you know, these squids, but they're in fact mechanized squids. They seem to be able to locomote using anti-gravity like the hovercraft. The Nebuchadnezzar texts them and goes into a quiet mode, and then you're told about the only defense they have against these things is an EMP pulse. But of course, if they trigger the pulse, it knocks out all the systems on the Nebuchadnezzar as well as the Sentinels. And it's the only weapon they have against the machines to knock them out. Of course, they're not detected. They pass unmolested. But again, the continued novelty of this film is you're again presented with yet another angle and yet another new idea and yet another cool thing, because you're following these Sentinels through the, you know, the underground tunnels of the Matrix. So it's a new visual scheme, too, that you're introduced to. This movie continually throws these things at you over and over and over again, which is why it's so immersive, I think, and why you're taken for such a ride here, is that the novelty value is very high. Something that's very difficult to replicate in a sequel. You know, when you've shown everyone your world, it just becomes that much more difficult to do in a sequel. You know, how are you going to up the ante when novelty, you know, and novelty is something that follows you scene by scene. When that's stripped away, you know, what replaces it? I'll get into that when we do the sequels. So now we have a scene where Cypher and Smith are having dinner, and you realize that Cypher's the mole. He's talking about Smith wants the codes to the Zion mainframe. So I guess that somehow the Zion mainframe is hackable. Smith wants the codes, and of course Cypher doesn't have them, but the codes are given to the captain of every hovercraft that leaves Zion. So Morpheus has the codes. So we get the understanding that somehow Cypher now needs to betray Morpheus in a way that he's captured so they can extract these codes from him. The next main sequence is Neo's visit to the Oracle. We don't know much about the Oracle. We're told there is an Oracle. They take Neo to see the Oracle. It's another terrific sequence. Basically, you know, for a sci-fi film, right, they spend a lot of time in sort of low-income housing. The Oracle lives in what looks like sort of a low-income housing block. A woman answers the door, Morpheus and Neo walk in, and we see these other hopefuls waiting for them. They're all doing, you know, one woman is juggling with her mind, and then he sits with one kid who is bending spoons. And of course, you know, he tries it. The child tells him, you know, don't try to bend the spoon. That's impossible. Only recognize the truth, which is there is no spoon. And of course, they're in the Matrix now. So that's true, actually. And of course, Neo bends it. There's some really cool visual effects where you see Neo's face in the bent spoon. Again, you know, they do that over and over in the film. And personally, every time I see it, I just get a kick out of it. I really like it. Now he goes in to see the Oracle. And again, for a sci-fi film, everyone here is all the controlling, I wouldn't say controlling, but the figures of authority here are all African-American. You know, Morpheus is African-American. The Oracle is African-American. And again, I think this is a great subversion of sci-fi tropes. I mean, sci-fi has been white-fi for decades. You know, it's been like white man's arena in terms of the majority of science fiction, the casting, the directing, the writing, right? This is just very refreshing. The Oracle, played by the wonderful Gloria Leonard. So his big moment with the Oracle is in a kitchen, is in a rundown kitchen. The Oracle's making cookies. An incredible subversion, right, where the Oracle is this holy, usually a man, first of all, usually on some mountain or in a, it's usually some august thing where you go to an Oracle. It's a very high thing, and the Oracle's maybe serviced by people or whatever. This is Gloria Leonard in the kitchen making cookies, dressed in like a house frock. She's marvelous, by the way. She is just eyes like saucers and very, very real. And they talk a bit. Then here we go again with the hero failing She tells me not the one. As an audience member, of course, we're waiting for the confirmation that Neo is the chosen one. And what do we get? We get that he's not the one. And she tells him, you know, in order to know yourself, she tells him you have the gift, but you're waiting for something. And you don't know what it is. But then we get a little bit of foreshadowing, and this is integral to the plot that comes up. And she says, you're going to have to make a choice again, because you and Morpheus, you know, one of you is going to die. And Morpheus is going to sacrifice his life to save yours. And how that turns out is uncertain. But what is certain is that one of the two of you will die. Who that is up to Neo, she says. The choice is going to be up to you, whether it's you or Morpheus. So again, very enigmatic. And he walks out of there with the knowledge that he is not the one. And again, subverting the normal sci-fi and fantasy tropes. And you as a viewer, you know, first time, you're like, what the fuck, man? Is he like not, you know, is the one going to arrive in the sequel? What's going on, you know? Now, again, this movie moves so well. Neo's gotten all the information that he's going to need at this point. Like, we're done educating Neo, right? So he's been given the knowledge that, or Morpheus believes that he is a person who can transcend the Matrix, can do these amazing things. The Oracle has given him this knowledge that he is not that person, but that he will have the power to make a decision in the future that's going to affect Morpheus's life. So our hero Neo has gotten all the info that he's going to need for probably the rest of this film. And now we move on to the betrayal of Cypher, which is terrific. You know, you're right into the next sequence. So go back to the building where they jacked into the Matrix. And of course, once they get back in there, Smith and the agents cut off all access, so they're unable to jack out. It's done in a great way. Again, they visualize it rather than making it technical by Neo seeing having a deja vu experience, seeing a black cat. It freaks all of them out. And then they call the operator and they realize that they've been compromised. And so there's a brief gun battle where Mouse, who's another member of the Nebuchadnezzar, is killed. And then they do a very cool thing that, you know, they use the reality of the world in a very cool way, because they're trapped and the agents are coming. And so Morpheus asks Tank to pull up a schematic diagram of the building and to find out where the nearest wet wall is. For those of you who don't know much about building maintenance, which I would say is most of you, the wet wall is designed to a building where there will be a wall where most of the piping that provides water and removes waste will come up a singular or maybe two wet walls or three in a building. And you'll design the rooms around this wet wall. So the bathrooms on every floor, you know, will be in the same location because the wet wall is serving them. I currently work in building maintenance and management right now. So I laughed when that happened. I was like, oh yeah, it makes a lot of sense. The speculative element of it, whether the wet wall is large enough to hold them all, as they basically poke a hole in the wall and they all disappear inside the wet wall, which I can tell you is about the grossest place in the known universe that you want to be. Rats and bugs, and it's disgusting. I mean, it's dark and moist most of the time and almost no air gets in there. But this is Hollywood, so the wet wall's kind of cool and quite dry. They're filming it from an angle where, you know, an impossible angle in a sense that they've sliced off the side of a set. So you can see clearly the wet wall versus building where the agents are searching for them. You know, you could have done a dozen Hollywood or sci-fi things to get them out of this building. But to use something that's grounded in real-world architecture, terrific choice. There's a point where Cypher sneezes because someone kicked dust on his face. And you as a viewer, you don't know whether he allowed himself to sneeze because he needed to prevent Morpheus from getting away, or he actually sneezed quite inadvertently. It's very ambiguous, but Cypher sneezes, and so the agents know that they're in the walls. They start shooting at them. Morpheus then screams to Trinity to get Neo out, and he crashes through one of the walls, and he and Smith face off for the first time. It's a great scene where Smith is like, the great Morpheus, we meet at last. Morpheus goes, and you are? And then Smith goes, Smith will suffice. And Morpheus goes, you all look the same to me. You know, and a great racial reversal, right? So it's great. It's just it's a nice little, you know, racial elbow in the ribs. So they fight, and it's a good fight. Again, they're fighting in a bathroom. Still, you know, the camera's back far enough where you can see the blows landing. Morpheus is utterly, you know, outclassed, and he's beaten and done and taken. And then Cypher's continuing betrayal where... So they find an alternate exit. So the rest of them escape, actually. They get out. But Cypher is the one who gets back first. It's back to the Nebuchadnezzar, and he kills Dozer with what looks like a big sort of electrical welding apparatus of some kind. Looks like he kills Tank and Dozer, drops the weapon. As Trinity's about to jack out, they have this conversation where, you know, Cypher's now in the Nebuchadnezzar, and she realizes he's betrayed them. So he begins to kill the rest of the crew. Apoc, Switch are killed because he pulls the spikes out of their head, but you actually have to download back into your own brain. He severs the connection while the consciousness is in the Matrix. So your consciousness kind of has to return to the Matrix, and then you can safely pull that jack out of the back of your skull and you're back. But if it's pulled out prematurely, you're dead, because it kind of sort of separates your consciousness from your body and you're done. So he kills Switch, he kills Apoc, and he's about to kill Neo when, in a nice Han Solo moment, Tank actually wakes up, grabs the welding gun, and kills Cypher, allowing Trinity and Neo to return to the Nebuchadnezzar. So now we move to a conversation between between Smith and Morpheus. And the Wachowskis take their time here to deliver some nice philosophical ideas. Smith explains to Morpheus that the first Matrix that was loaded, the machines decided, in order to pacify human beings and keep them really happy, the first Matrix was a paradise where there was no suffering. No one suffered. Everyone was happy and fulfilled and content. The line of the film is, it was a disaster, that humans rejected it. So there's this great notion of, like, you know, getting into the nature of what it means to be human, that we would reject utopia. if we ever get there, we would reject it outright. So again, great mind candy to play with while you're watching this movie. It's such a great, they do both so well. He throws another idea out, and then he compares the human race to a virus. He says, you know, I've had a revelation that every mammal finds a way to blend with their environment. They find an equilibrium with it, except one, human beings, where they exhaust an environment, drain it of its resources, and somewhat destroy it, and then move on to the next. And he says that there's only one other organism that does this, and it's called a virus. You can take that out of the movie and you can argue about it all day, that it's a terrific notion that has validity. So those two nuggets delivered. Now we're back into the story. And Neo realizes, Tank and Trinity now realize that since Morpheus is captured, it's only a matter of time until his brainwaves change their characteristics. And in that moment, Morpheus will tell them anything they want to know in the Zion mainframe codes. So Tank is like, we have to, you know, there's no alternative. We have to kill Morpheus. And he's about to pull the spike when Neo realizes that this is the moment the Oracle told him about, that he had to make this choice to sacrifice his life for Morpheus or let Morpheus die. So he tells Tank and Trinity to wait, and basically tells him that, you know, he believes that he can bring Morpheus back because of what the Oracle said, you know, that if he simply makes the choice to do it, that it will work. They both are like, you're crazy, and he's in a building guarded by dozens of agents, you'll never get him out alive. And then he also tells, he's like, you know, he sacrificed himself to get you out. And then he tells them, well, that was a mistake because the Oracle told me that I'm not the one. You know, there's no reason for him to die. There's no reason for him to get me out. You know, I believe I can get this guy back. It's a plausible reason for them to go back into the Matrix to try, which is, you know, again, in action movies, when writers are respecting their audiences, you're moving into the movie in just a greater way. They ask Neo what his plan is. He's like, guns, lots of guns. From this point on, the movie goes into sort of its last final act. The next couple of sequences get really, really out there in a sense. It obviously you're in a world where you could, you know, make anything happen. But up till now, most of the things that have gone on have been, although fantastical, fairly rooted in sort of things that happen in real life and the way gun battles are and the way people fight and so on and so forth. But now there's this sort of bubble of hyper-reality now comes in, where Trinity and Neo enter the lobby of this building with just guns and explosives. You know, cue the techno soundtrack. They enter into this huge battle where there's tons of slow-mo. The lobby itself is made out of this easily ablative stonework. So at points in the battle, it's quite beautiful at times, that Neo or Trinity are running through like a sea of fragmented stonework and dust. Like, and it's pretty cool. I mean, as in terms of, you know, visual action movies, again, the Wachowskis were, you know, they really dialed it up a notch. But it's there's something about the fight to me that's a little goofy. The music is kind of like, the music makes it more of like a fast, fun thing. The way they're fighting and, you know, dodging bullets and someone shooting at them and they duck and, you know, then kick the gun out of the guy's hand. There's a lot of that in this fight. You know, dozens and dozens of bullets. So they kill everyone. They get into an elevator. They make their way to the roof. So they get to the roof finally. There's a battle. Now there's an agent on the roof. At some point, the agent and Neo face off, and Neo, you know, enters, basically empties all his clips, and the agent moves in this incredibly fast way, evades every bullet. You know, it echoes what Morpheus says earlier when he's training Neo. People have entered entire clips at them and hit nothing. So now the agent starts firing at Neo, and now you're into bullet time again, and you're also into a bit of the 360 as the agent is shooting at Neo. He's sort of bending back, avoiding the bullets in a similarly quick way. And near the end, two bullets graze him. And the agent walks up and it's like only human after all and is about to kill him. And then Trinity is there with a gun pressed against his temple with his great line, "Dodge this," kills him. And again, the shot is terrific. Trinity pulls the trigger and you get the reaction of the body as it falls. A great shot. And again, Carrie Ann Moss, just very commanding. And then another great plot moment where they need the helicopter. Neo asks Trinity, "Can you fly this?" And she says, "Not yet." Tank loads in a pilot program into her brain. And in like 3 or 4 seconds, she's like, "Let's go." So they get in this helicopter and she pilots it down. And there's a Gatling gun, a massive gun on the helicopter. And they hover right at the same level where Smith is questioning Morpheus. And Neo starts shooting. This is, again, we're back in reality. Like, the way he's using this Gatling gun, he would have killed Morpheus, like, 10 times over. It's the way the bullets are spraying, and even how it's shot. You know, like, how could have Morpheus survived? But it's really cool, and there's this one shot directly below the helicopter. The rotors are spinning in slow motion, and there's just this rain of brass shell casings that come out. It's really cool. He kills all the agents in the room. Morpheus gets up and runs to the helicopter, but of course he's too weak to make it. So Neo ties looks like that scene from My Favorite Year when Peter O'Toole ties the hose to him, or in Die Hard, which is probably from Die Hard. McClane ties the hose to his belt, jumps out the window. So Neo ties what looks like some kind of big fire hose. I don't know why it was in the helicopter, but it's a movie. He jumps out and grabs Morpheus midair. Trinity takes off, so they're now. Great stunt work, and just the shot, like, it's very real. It's not a CGI. There's definitely a helicopter, and it's dangling some bodies. As they're pulling away, one of the agents inhabits a fresh body and empties their gun at the helicopter, and one of the bullets pierces the gas tank. It's a cool scene of they drop Morpheus and Neo, but Neo still has the sort of fire hose wrapped around him, and the helicopter goes down. Neo's hoping Trinity grabs onto the fire hose, and of course she does. The helicopter smashes into the side of a building, and the building buckles as if when the helicopter hits the side of a building, it's as if like it fell into a pond. There's these great ripples, you know, in the Matrix, right? Which is really cool. You're given this brief visual clue to the audience, like, by the way, you know, this isn't the real world. And of course, Trinity has tied herself to the other end of this fire hose. Neo pulls her up, and they're all rescued. So now we're entering the end game, and Morpheus and Trinity and Neo head down to a subway station, which is where their exits are. And these exits, again, maybe I haven't made clear that phones are sort of jacking in, jacking out terminals. So it was a phone and a phone line, which is how you realize that Trinity got out in the beginning when she went into the phone booth and the people disappear. So Morpheus gets in the phone booth. And there's a very cool effect of him sort of de-rezzing as his consciousness jacks out. And that effect startles a homeless man who's sleeping in the station. And he wakes up and looks and he sees them. And as Trinity and Neo are talking, Trinity's about to tell him something that, you know, "Neo, there's something I want to tell you, but I'm afraid of what it could mean." And at that moment, you realize that what the bum is seeing, now Smith is seeing. And there's a shot of Smith turning around. Neo has her go into the phone booth to jack out. And as she's jacking out, Smith appears where the homeless man was lying. And the Trinity realizes, like, "You have to send me back." But of course, at that moment, the lines are cut. and Neo is now stuck there. And now we enter into the final fight of the film. And there's this great moment where Neo decides he's not going to run. He's going to stand his ground. He's beginning to believe in himself as someone who can do great things. They have this great fight. They start by running at each other and emptying their clips. And they both end up face to face with guns at each other's heads. There's this great line. Smith says to Neo, "You're out." And Neo says, "So are you." So they drop the guns. They start their fight. And it's a terrific fight. And it's filmed in the same way that the Morpheus-Neo fight was filmed. Lots of long takes. You see the choreography of the fights. You see multiple hits land in one take on each side. And so you get a sense of the strategy. And little by little, you know, Neo, while he puts up a hell of a fight, just gets his ass handed to him eventually. Smith finally grabs him. There's a great sequence of where, you know, a piece of paper blows, and you close up on Smith and you realize he knows the train's coming. And then he looks back at Neo. And it's a great moment where you know as an audience member what's going to happen next because of the way it was shot. It's perfect. So much of what cinema should be, you know, that those visual cues are right in there with the script. And you're getting cues and you're getting all kinds of things from the visuals as well as exposition. Smith drags Neo in front of the train and he's holding him there. And of course, he doesn't care if the body he's in gets demolished because he'll just appear in a new one. It's this great moment where, you know, Keanu Reeves gets his action movie line where Smith says something about Mr. Anderson and he says, "My name is Neo," and he leaps up, smashes Smith against the ceiling. Smith falls down dazed, and then Neo does a backflip out of the way of the train, which demolishes Smith. It's a terrific last moment action movie win, as it were. So Neo is now walking away, and all of a sudden, the train that is coming in, the brakes slam. Of course, Neo does not run. He's not sure what this means. He stops on the steps, turns around. The door of the train opens, and out walks Smith as if nothing's ever happened. And he realizes at that moment that right in his current state of abilities, these guys are unbeatable. So he runs. At the same time, back on the Nebuchadnezzar, the Sentinels now have detected the Nebuchadnezzar and are closing in. The dramatic fulcrum now upon which this rests is that if they trigger the EMP while Neo's still in the Matrix, all of the apparatus connecting him will turn off and his mind will be separated from his body. He dies. Now you watch as the Sentinels grab onto the ship and start to laser open it up, tear into it. And on the other hand, now Neo is running from the agents, and he's got Tank guiding him to go into this room, go into that room. And there's some great sequences where he bursts through a room where an old woman's cooking dinner. By the time he gets to the other end of the room, a knife appears next to his head, and he turns, and it's Smith. You know, so you get this notion of like the agents are leapfrogging through people to keep up. So through dodging bullets and dodging agents, he finally gets in front of this room 101, which is where the movie began, which was the room where Trinity was busted by the agents initially. He opens the door, and Smith is standing behind it and shoots him. And it's all done in slow-mo. You know, you as the audience, great reversal. He backs up into the door. He shoots him again. He doesn't go down and empties the whole gun into Neo. And Neo backs up into the hallway, drops. Anderson asks another agent to check him. The agent takes his pulse. He's dead. So Morpheus and Trinity see this, and they don't know what to do. The Sentinels are tearing through the ship. They're completely blown away. They don't know what's going on. Morpheus is like, but he's the one. And then Trinity has a little scene where she says, "The Oracle told me I would fall in love, and that man would be the one." So she's like, "So you can't be dead because I love you." And through the power of love, ladies and gentlemen, Neo is resurrected. And he wakes and stands up. And when he does, in that moment, you see from his point of view that he is looking at the Matrix in an entirely new way. So the shot of the hallway and the agents consists of green characters. The whole thing is in green characters. And of course, the film swells now with a chorale cue. All the agents, the three arms of the agents rise and they empty their guns at Neo. And Neo calmly looks and says, "No." And all the bullets stop right in front of him. It's a great bullet time moment, hearkening back to Morpheus's telling him in the training sequence, you know, when the time is right, you won't have to dodge bullets. Morpheus, of course, he is the one. You hear him say it. And Neo picks a bullet out of the air and looks at it as if he's looking at a, you know, piece of dirt. all the bullets just drop down. He looks at the agents, and he starts running towards Smith. And this great moment dives into Smith. These weird bubbles start to happen, and basically Smith explodes. And in his place, Neo emerges, flexes his muscles, and the other two agents run. So I want to talk about the death of Neo because I think it's a really amazing and important moment in the movie. That it may seem like, you know, if at first glance, some kind of plot machination to add dramatical weight to the end of the movie, that he's going to die and that he'll be brought back to life by Trinity's love. But in fact, the way I see it, the way I look at it, and the way I really enjoy to process this film, is that the Wachowskis really have subverted the hero's journey. They really have. Neo as a hero is kind of an epic failure over and over and over again. He, in his first test, when Morpheus is talking him through his job to escape the agents, he fails. When again he's offered a ride in the car and take off his shirt, he refuses. He's about to get out. He has to be coaxed back in the car. When he's in the dojo with Morpheus, you know, he can't really get past his limitations in that moment. There's a moment when you see a glimmer of it, but then he goes to the jump program, fails utterly. The continual failure extends to when he goes to visit the Oracle. She tells him point blank, "You're not the one," over and over and over again. So in his limited mindset, yes, he does rescue Morpheus and he succeeds, and then utterly fails to beat Smith. Even though he beats Smith in a heroic effort that takes everything he has, Smith walks out of the train completely unscathed and ready to do that over and over and over and over again, dozens and dozens of times, and Neo knows he doesn't have it in him. And it actually takes a death, actually takes him to die, for him to resurrect sort of into the One. And it takes an energy and a set of information from another source. In this case, it's Trinity and her love for him that infuses him and allows him to finally release the limitations of his old way of looking at things. I think this is a terrific example of what it takes to transform spiritually. When one transforms in their life, spiritual transformations are often these incredible shifts of perspective. After the shift of perspective, one usually looks back and sees, in a sense, it's still amazing that one achieves that sort of new perspective. And you realize that it does take, you do struggle until the very last moment, until the very last breath, because all you know, all you can do is to use the same rules and the same strategies and the same things over and over and over again. You don't know anything else. You actually literally cannot conceive of a new way to perceive the world. And the Wachowskis, I think, understand this, and they understand that to go through a true transformative process takes a death of your ego, a death of your expectations. You know, you letting go of something that you thought at some point in your life you could never let go of. It's wonderfully portrayed in an action movie as the protagonist actually dying. His death, I think, makes incredible thematic sense if you're interested in reading the movie the way I am, and you might not be. But I read the underlying theme of this movie as really a spiritual transformation from Neo. You know, and the One being indicative of, he's the one who can make this transformation. And then later on, he can guide others to do the same. You know, from his awakening from the Matrix to the real world was one journey. Neo made the next one. You know, that no one else, Morpheus or any of his crew or anyone else of the humans who have left the Matrix, they're stuck still in this limbo. And it takes Neo to allow them to ascend actually to the next level of existence, which I think this death quite well represents. Now, the only problem with this moment is that the way the film was cut, the timing of the Sentinel attack and all of this that's happening to Neo, is that there's a moment where the Sentinels are already in the ship and they're already almost on the deck, the main flight deck. And that's the moment where Trinity has her speech and then Neo has his transformation. So all this time passes. And as a viewer, it's sort of like the Sentinels just started to rest for 15 minutes while all this other stuff happened. So it's the only thing, it's mistimed. They wait so long. So it's the only problem I have with that scene is just you realize that the Sentinels would have had them already, that somehow the timing of the Sentinels needed to be shifted. Anyway, if you've seen it, you'll notice what I'm talking about, where it's like It's just like a big pause on the Sentinel attack. Film ends, and it ends wonderfully ambiguous. You don't have this post-discussion about everything. You know, the next scene is basically Neo in a phone booth speaking to the Matrix itself, saying, you know, I'm giving you notice. And there's the beginning of this Rage Against the Machine song. The camera pulls back up from a long shot, which is, again, very comic booky. And you realize Neo flies up and away. And then the Rage Against the Machine song kicks in. A couple of things to just recap. That I think this film succeeds because of the incredible attention to detail that the writers and directors paid shot by shot. It is a lean film. Every scene and sequence in this film builds character, moves the plot forward, shows you the world. It's all done really well with an incredible economy of motion. Not only that, there's a novelty of this world. You've never seen this world before. And the way it unfolds is that you're seeing a little bit of more of it, a different type of piece of it every time you go through. The way they shot it. So like at every other frame, look at this new camera angle. Oh, look at this new part of the world. Here's this new bit of spirituality or philosophy the Wachowskis are throwing at me. Hey, look at this cool martial arts battle. Uh-oh, the hero's in trouble. Like, it all comes together perfectly. So you can watch the film on many levels. You know, you just want to watch an action film. You can go in and watch an action film, and it works, you know. If you're looking for something a little different, you can go in and puzzle out the philosophy. If you're looking for, you know, a martial arts film, you can go and just marvel at the martial arts. If you're a student of film and you just are looking at camera angles and the way things are shot, it's very inventive, you know. And it works on many levels. And the one coda here is that the Wachowskis are often given that this bullet time and this stuff, their movies, you know, the bullet time thing. But in fact, Blade, which I'll probably cover in a future podcast because I really like the movie, Blade has very similar bullet timey moments in the final battle in that movie, and it came out a year earlier. The most novel thing in terms of cinematic stuff is a 360-degree sweep, which they do, which is amazing. But strangely enough, you know, the Blade film also was playing with bullet timey like effects at the same time, you know. And it goes back to the sort of will new techniques in cinema arrive, whether one person discovers them or not, or is it truly a single person who brings new things out? It's like the great man of history theory, right? So anyway, I'm going to end this podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. I definitely enjoyed making it. I will see you next time. This is Sci-Fi on Screen.